A little over 10 years ago, our Pastor Doug and our staff, our leadership here at Hillcrest asked ourselves this question. We said, if we were to stop being a church, would anyone notice? Would anyone care if Hillcrest were to simply stop being a church? And the answer to that question was sadly, no. Now, that doesn't mean that there weren't some folks who would have missed us. If you were with us back then, I think and hope you would have missed us. I know I would have missed this place and being a part of this place. We have, we had some missionaries we were supporting at the time. I think they would have missed at least the financial contribution we were making to them. We partnered with some local organizations, and there were a couple, I think, that would have missed us being a church. But really, outside of those groups, this section of the city, this corner of the world would not have really noticed if we stopped being a church. And that wasn't even necessarily our fault. 10 years ago, a little over 10 years ago, we were doing church. We were programming church the way other churches were doing and programming church. And it was a bit of the, if you've seen the movie Field of Dreams, it was a bit of that mentality. If you build it, they will come. And so that idea applied to church. You built a really dynamic and energetic worship service. You had great teaching or preaching that was relevant and applicable, and we have that in Pastor Doug. And really, regardless of who's been leading our worship, they've provided that element for the 10 or so plus years. You have good youth and student ministries for children and students to be happy with, and so the moms and dads are happy. And you put that all together and you say, come to us, come to this church, make this church your home. And again, nothing wrong with that. That's not a wrong approach or a sinful approach. It's not a bad way to do church. It's just that approach of doing church becomes all about us. It becomes all about what we're doing here. It becomes all about, what's happening inside these walls. And so when we asked ourselves if anyone would miss us, we had to say, you know what? Not really. No one outside of us would really notice if we stopped being a church. And Bridge the Gap, this book I've written that I'm excited to share with you today, some of you maybe already have it, tells the story of how we tried to answer that question in the positive, primarily through our relationship with Cleveland Elementary. And a little over 10 years ago, we were poring over the Bible. We were looking at different scriptures. Pastor Ed was teaching on different things. And there's one chunk of scripture in particular I want to walk us through this morning that I think unveils or at least gives us some insight as to this mentality we have as a church, a mentality we had 10 plus years ago and that we still have today. And it comes from Jeremiah chapter 29. It's fitting that it's graduation Sunday. It's fitting that Eric said that was his favorite verse because this week I said, well, I'm going to wreck that verse for you. It's an awesome verse. I know the plans I have for you, declares the Lord, plans to prosper you and give you a hope and a future, not to harm you. I kind of butchered what you see on the screen, but that's the gist, right? That God has this amazing plan for you, and it's the perfect verse for graduation Sunday. Whether you're a high school grad or a college grad, it's the perfect verse. And so Christian companies have capitalized on that. And so, if you go to Amazon or if you go to christianbook.com, type in graduation gifts or religious graduation gifts, that verse is on, cards, greeting cards, it's on trinkets, it's on plaques, it's on mugs, it's on anything you want to put that. It's like perfect. In fact, you might have gotten a card from me, grads, that says that verse in there somewhere, okay? Because graduation is a time for optimism and enthusiasm and excitement. And who doesn't want to tell a grad, listen, God has big plans for you. The world is your oyster. The sky is your limit. There's nothing wrong with telling a graduate that. Absolutely nothing. And we had Emma and Amber, high school grads, in our last service. And we have Grant and we have Josh graduating that we recognize today, Brady and Cassie, who are not here. And I know all their families, and I know them to some degree as well as grads. And I know God has great plans for each of them. And it's going to be fun as a church to watch and see what God does in and through each of them. But that verse is not for graduates. And in fact, if you have your scriptures with you, or if you want to look in the Bibles in the seats in front of you, we're going to have the words on the screen, but I do want you to turn to Jeremiah 29. It's on page 601 if you're using the Bibles in the seats in front of you. And I want to point out to you the header that comes right before 29. And it says, in my version, it says, Jeremiah's letter to the exiles. Yours might just say a letter to the exiles. But that word exile should be a tip, should be a clue that Jeremiah is writing to a people that are in a very different frame of mind than a graduate, right? A letter to the exiles. Now, Jeremiah doesn't put that header in here. He doesn't put 29 in here. We've done that to help make the Bible more readable, to help break it up, to help give you an idea of what's coming next in this section or chapter that you're about to read. But the first three verses in 29 tell us that the Israelites have been exiled from the promised land, from Jerusalem. They now find themselves in Babylonian captivity. King Nebuchadnezzar has taken them and brought them back to Babylon. The Israelites have repeatedly ignored God's warnings and God's standards for how to live life. And prophet after prophet has warned the Israelites, listen, bad things are going to happen if you keep living this way. And finally, God delivers on the consequence and exiles them out of the promised land. And so we want to pick it up in verses 4 and following. This is what the Lord of Heaven's armies, the God of Israel, says to all the captives that he has exiled to Babylon from Jerusalem. Build homes and plan to stay. Plant gardens and eat the food they produce. Marry and have children. Then find spouses for them so that you may have many grandchildren. Multiply. Do not dwindle away. And work for the peace and prosperity of the city where I sent you into exile. Pray to the Lord for its welfare will determine your welfare. If you're following along in the soul provider today, your first fill-in is, bless your cities. So the Israelites have been removed from their home. And they find themselves in this foreign land under Babylonian control. And you get the sense, by what Jeremiah is telling them, that they think it's going to be kind of a short stay. Maybe a couple of weeks, maybe a couple of months, maybe a year tops, but that they would be back home in no time. And so Jeremiah walks them through a little bit what this exile looks like. He says, build homes, plant gardens. You can build a home or plant a garden in a few months, a year, maybe over a year. But then he continues, marry and have children. Find spouses for them so that you may have grandchildren. Multiply. It takes a while for your kids to be able to have grandkids. That's just how it works. And so this gives you the sense, this is not just this generation. This is going to extend to the next generation. This exile is going to take a long time. You're going to be gone a while. And then in verse 7, he says, pray to the Lord for the welfare of the city, for the city's welfare determines your welfare. How well the city does is how well you will do. And so you can see why verse 11, I know the plans I have for you, plans for hope and not for disaster. It is a hopeful verse. It is a positive verse. It's a verse that we can claim as followers of Jesus today, that it was a verse given to people who were in a very hopeless situation, who felt like their life had ended, who felt like they had nothing to look forward to, whose whole world had been turned upside down. and they're in exile. And exile can look a little bit differently for us today. I think there's a couple of different ways to look at exile. For some of us, it can feel like exile when we're going through difficult times or suffering or, you know, difficult circumstances. I know some of us here are going through tough times. We're going through, you know, tough financial things, tough medical things, tough relational things. And it can feel like God has abandoned you. It can feel like wanting to know where God is in this. Why does it feel like God has left me? How come God is doing this to me? How come God has caused this? And when we talk about exile today, we're not talking about those of us who are going through those types of times. It's okay to doubt. It's okay to question. It's okay to yell at God or ask God, where are you? Why am I going through this? Why have you forsaken me? The scriptures contain words similar to those. And so if you find yourself in a difficult time that feels like God has abandoned you, it's okay to question and have doubts and concerns. God is big enough to handle those. That's not the type of exile we're talking about today. We're talking about an exile from a cultural perspective. And when the Israelites arrive in Babylon, they find themselves in a very foreign and different land. Their culture is completely gone. Their way of life, how they live life, their religious practices, their cultural customs, just the whole way they go about living life is done. It's been turned upside down. They're under someone else's control now. And Jeremiah or God must have sensed that they had this short-term perspective because he says it's going to take a while. And he wants to cut off this temptation that he senses they're having by saying, don't pull out of this new culture. Don't withdraw. Don't isolate yourself. Build, plant, marry, have children. And oh, by the way, how well the city does is how well you're going to do. So if you're contributing to this culture, if you're contributing to this community, if this community is better off because you're involved in it, then you're going to be better off. But if this city, if this community, if this culture isn't different because of your involvement, then your exile may take a little longer. When Christians, when we find ourselves in exile, we're tempted to withdraw and separate. And the Christian author, Beth Moore, said it like this. She says, we've got this Noah instinct, this drive in us to build arks and to shut ourselves in with our own kind. Then we shut ourselves further in with our phones. Then we get claustrophobic, bored, and wonder why. Open a window and watch for a dove with an olive twig. There's life out there. Obviously referring to the biblical event of the flood and Noah. But the truth remains that when we find ourselves as followers of Jesus in precarious cultural circumstances, there's this temptation to withdraw and to isolate and to detach. And we build our own organizations, we build our own culture, and we attach the adjective Christian to it. And we say it's a Christian this or a Christian that. And so that makes it, you know, preferred or okay. No more do we see this than how the church has interacted with the public school. And in the book, I talk about the recent Christian response to public school to either, you know, educate in a faith-based or private setting or the growing popularity of the homeschool movement. And I want to be clear today that those are fine and great and wonderful options. I am not here to tear down those choices. I'm not here to tear down those options. Those are great choices, great options. Brian is not against Sioux Falls Christian, or Brian is not against homeschooling, okay? We're recording this, so we've got it on the tape, okay? But I do ask in the book, and I wonder aloud sometimes, what if every Christian family made those decisions? What if every Christian decided, you know what, the public school is too hostile to our faith, it's too hostile to the values we're trying to impart on our children, and so we're going to pull out. We're going to, you know, consider a different way. I think if every Christian family did that, we would be turning our backs on one of the biggest areas or biggest places in our culture where we can have significant impact. And so when Hillcrest was asking the question about the church and whether we were would be missed, Trina and I were also asking the question, where is Riley going to go to school? And we live really equidistant between here and Cleveland, smack dab in the middle, about a half mile from here and a half mile from the school. And in our section of the neighborhood, there were 15 kids in just like six or seven homes. That didn't even include my tribe, okay? 15 kids going to school, and none of them went to Cleveland. Two families homeschooled, two families open enrolled, two families went to faith-based schools, but no one was sending their kid to the school that was the closest to us, at least geographically. And we're like, man, that's interesting that that's happening. That's interesting that no one is doing that. And so we're having that discussion at home. We're having that discussion at church about how to be a church the community would miss. And if you remember, if you were here back then, Pastor Doug was teaching and preaching. We were going through, you know, all kinds of scripture about having an impact in our day-to-day lives. We pulled you as a church, and kind of the big theme from that was children. It was one of the overarching themes from those surveys was we care about kids. And through that, we kind of narrowed in on some things to specifically live out our care for kids. And adoption became one of those things. Foster care became one of those things. And then Cleveland also became one of those things where we're going to live out our care for children in real tangible ways by partnering with that school. And you can't see the posters. VBS has kind of taken over in here. But when you come here on a Sunday morning, you see these posters. And they have different names to them. They have different ministries or different groups or different places. All those posters, they've evolved a little bit in the last 10 to 11 years, but all those posters came from that time, 10 to 11 years ago. That's where these things on the walls came from. And the second fill-in today is bless your schools. And there's different ways to do this. The book is just one way about how we as a church decided to bless the school. And it's encouraging to see churches, not just here, but other churches beginning to consider or having considered how they can bless schools too. Because 10, 11 years ago, churches had one of two relationships with the public school. The first relationship was they just pretended they did not exist. You know, the church didn't really acknowledge the school. The school had no reason to acknowledge a church, and we just, you know, operated independently of each other, even though we knew each other existed. The second way was that the church tended to look at the school as kind of a mission field. And so we would have after-school Bible clubs and after-school youth activities for the public school students. The church or the school couldn't put them during the school day because that's a, you know, violation of church-state separation and the establishment clause and all that good stuff. But the church would kind of do stuff before school or after school. And then something would happen. You know, a parent would get upset, or the church would violate that relationship some way by sending stuff home through the kids or what have you. And the school would get kind of, you know, antsy with the relationship and kind of pull the plug. The church was like, oh, that was too bad. But never in that model did the church consider, how can we serve the school? How can we bless the school? What can we do for the school? And so that's, the book really is kind of a third way for churches to consider blessing schools. How can we help? Not what can you do for us, but what can we do for you? What do you need? And how can we help provide that need? And in the midst of that, ministry happens. I remember when we first sent Reading Buddies over to Cleveland, volunteers, you were them. And you would go and you would read with students for 15 minutes or a half hour, an hour a day. And I would get calls and emails saying that this little girl I read with, she asked about Jesus today. Unprompted, unsolicited, just out of the blue. Jackie, Dr. McNamara, we knew her as Dr. McNamara back then, but you know her as Jackie today. And she was in first service, and she would call Doug or call myself and just say, hey, could you pray for, you know, this family, or could you pray for this staff member, or pray for this situation? Wouldn't share names, wouldn't share details, but would share enough that we would pray, because she knew that this place was a place of prayer and a place that we would care for what she was sharing. It's not all roses, though. Your final fill-in is bless the mess. Trina has this ball cap she wears. It's the only ball cap I've seen her wear in over 18 years of marriage. But she wears this ball cap that says, bless this mess. And I think it's fitting for this type of ministry. If you're going to partner with the public school, if you're going to do anything outside of the norm when it comes to, you know, church and ministry, you need to expect it to be messy. And so our first year partnering with Cleveland, they decided they needed some winter gear. They needed hats and boots and snow pants and gloves and that type of thing. Lots of students had that need. And we said, sure. You know, they sent us the ages and the style or the sizes that every kid needed. We put it on that bulletin board right there. And if you were here then, you grabbed a couple of things. You went to the store, picked out a couple of things and brought them here. And then we got to bring them over to the school because, you know, that's fun being Santa Claus, right? Just kind of drop all this stuff off. And that sounds win-win, doesn't it? School has a need. We have resources. We went out and got stuff. We brought it to them. Win-win. You know, cue the music. Start the tears, right? Make you feel real good. Well, a couple of days after we dropped the stuff off, Jackie calls and says, we got a problem. And what was happening was some students were not exactly thrilled with the stuff they got because other students got other stuff. And one little girl got a black coat and she wanted a purple coat like her friend got. And one little boy, you know, got the knockoff brand of snow boots and someone else got North Face. It wasn't North Face, but, you know, like that kind of brand difference. And so here we had inadvertently created this class culture inside of what was supposed to be doing good. And I'll tell you my initial response, it was ignorant, but it was honest and raw. I was mad. I was angry. I'm like, what? And I felt like I was defending all of you, because like here, you took your time, your resources, your energy, you bought awesome stuff. Who are they to complain about the stuff that they received? And I looked at some of that stuff, and I said, you know what, some of that stuff, a lot of that stuff, they're nicer than my kids are wearing. But Trina's kind of a thrift store junkie, so she, you know, searches deals like that. It's nicer, newer stuff, at least, than the stuff that my own kids are wearing. How dare you complain? How dare you fuss about something that someone had given to you? It was a mess. We created this mess for them. And internally, in my own soul, it was a mess because I had a lot to learn when it came to helping and walking alongside those who are under-resourced. And we learned from that. We grew from that. The next year, we did the winter clothing drive. It looked a lot differently. This year, we didn't even do one. And we rely on them now, the staff and the leadership over at Cleveland, to say, hey, we've got kids with this need. And sometimes we pick up the stuff. Sometimes we just say, here's a Walmart card or here's a Target card or whatever. Go get what you think they want. Kind of cut out some of that. And the book talks about some other comical examples of how messy it can be to be a blessing to a school. It can be messy to be a blessing to anyone outside of ourselves. I look at these things on the walls, or I remember the stories. You know, we've done mentoring through the Genesis Project through community outreach. That's messy. You're walking with people who are trying to get their finances right, and it's messy. Several here in this service today have been to South Sudan. You could write books about the messes you've encountered over there, about how messy that ministry is. We used to run a tutoring center with Wesleyan Methodist Church right by Whittier called Powerhouse. Oh my goodness, mess after mess, problem after problem. It's messy. We're going to build this school, this high school in Ortoro over in Ethiopia that you have committed your resources to, and that's amazing. But it's going to be messy. And if you think that, you know, we because we said we're going to build a school and that in 6 months a school is going to be built and it's going to go off without a hitch. Goodness, we can't build a school here without it going off without a hitch. And then you know, language barriers and cultural barriers, and how do you get resources to that part of the country? There's going to be messes. We might not know about all those messes. We might. I don't know. There's going to be hiccups and challenges and opportunities along the way. And we can either go, you know what? We can either say when we look at messes, we can see a mess, and that can be we can interpret that as a confirmation we're not supposed to be doing that type of thing. Or we can look at a mess and say that's exactly where God wants us to be. And how can we bless through that? How can we be an example in that circumstance? In John chapter 17, Jesus prays over his disciples on the doorstep of his betrayal and crucifixion. I want to pick up the prayer for us in verses 15 and following. Jesus prays this: I'm not asking you to take them out of the world, but to keep them safe from the evil one. They do not belong to this world any more than I do. Make them holy by your truth. Teach them your word, which is truth. And just as you sent me into the world, I am sending them into the world. And these are some of Jesus' last recorded words before his death and his resurrection. He doesn't ask his Father, he doesn't ask God to remove his followers from the world. In fact, he asks to keep us in there, but to protect us. We get the cliche, in the world but not of the world, from this passage. And those words in blue there, make them holy, your version might say sanctify. We get sanctification from those words. And we often think of sanctification or holiness as this activity that we do on our own in isolation. We think we need to go out to nature or go to a retreat center or to a monastery and unplug and, get one with God through that. And those are all very beneficial things. But Jesus is not praying that in this passage. This idea of holiness and sanctification has an active component to it. It's a prayer of action. He's saying, make them holy, because he knows what's coming next for his followers. And when you read the book of Acts, you see a people who are on fire for the gospel, who are on fire for Jesus. Jesus was a man of action, and he expects those of us who follow him to be people of action. It's why in Matthew 22, in the Great Commandment, Jesus says, love God and love others. In Matthew 28, in the Great Commission, he says, go and teach and make disciples and baptize. Those are active words. Those are actions that we are to be about. In the book of Acts, chapter 1, verse 8, before Jesus ascends into heaven, he says, you will be my witnesses in Jerusalem and in Judea and in Samaria and to all the ends of the world. Active action. It's also awesome how Jerusalem is the first one there. What's Jerusalem? It's a city. Be a witness first in the city. Be a witness first in the city that God has planted you, that God has put you. I want to thank you as a church for the incredible opportunity to have taken the sabbatical last summer, to have written this book, and for your support and encouragement to get it to this point in the journey. And I owe a lot of gratitude to Sherry Levesay, who edited it, and to Sam Otis, who designed it, because without those two people, you'd just be looking at a messy Word document. And so they helped it make it a little bit more readable for you. And at the conclusion of the service, there's books in the foyer. I invite you to stop by and get one. And if you were with us as a church 10 to 11 years ago, I hope the book is like a memoir for you. I hope when you read it, you look through it and smiles are brought to your face, maybe tears brought to your eyes as you go through some of those stories and events that have made us who we are today. And you look back and you go, I forgot about that. Or, yeah, I remember how awesome that was. And if you weren't with us back then, maybe you've been here a couple of years, the book will provide context for you for why this church is so awesome and how we are a people who have a bias for action. This church, the book will give you some understanding as to how this church can support close to 100 kids in Otoro because of that vision that God gave us 11 years ago and how the leadership and the people here obeyed and responded. And if you're newer to our community today, or maybe this is your first time here, you just heard about this and wanted to check it out, I hope the book, I hope the message, I hope what we're trying to do here encourages you to consider that in your own part of our community or somewhere else. And since we started partnering with Cleveland, there's been lots of other churches who have taken up the idea to partner with the school. But there's so many more schools that need that partnership. So many more schools, so many pockets in our community who need the church to be the tangible hands and feet of Jesus. So I thank you. Let's pray. Father, I'm grateful. I am humbled to be here today. I thank you so much for this church, and for her openness, her obedience, and her bias for action. I thank you that we were able to partner with Cleveland, that we have been able to partner with them. I look forward to seeing how you will continue to use each and every one of us here today for your kingdom. Father, may you bless us as we go about the rest of this day. And we pray these things in your name.